Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Dana R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, your host, with not with Delilah Jones of Imagine Publicity this evening, although she is taking a little sabbatical for some fun. We do have substitute guest co-host Michelle S. Cruz, advocate, super crime victim advocate and attorney from Connecticut and Massachusetts area with me this evening, and I welcome all of you across the nation if this is your first time listening or if you're a veteran. We so appreciate your patronage and the ability to impart this information and let people know. And if you can't listen from 5 to 6 p.m. every Saturday, please do rest assured that all of these radio shows are available for your listening pleasure on our archives. And so before I introduce our topic, I have to say, Delilah, I hope you're having fun. And in your place this evening, we have my very good friend and colleague, Michelle Cruz, who I think needs no introduction to our audience, but she's a very accomplished person. She was the constitutional victim advocate under Governor Jody Emerell for several years. She fought diligently for the fought against the early release program in Connecticut that let out 7,500 violent offenders, including a particular one who was released and murdered someone. She was instrumental in advocating for the creation of a state missing persons unit within the Connecticut Department of Emergency Services and Public Protection. She's very skilled with regard to domestic violence issues and sexual assault and a myriad of other types of cases. And currently, she is in private law practice serving clients in Massachusetts and Connecticut. And I have to say she's very victim-focused. And so without further ado, Michelle, thank you so much for being my co-host. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. And that was a really long introduction. And I always get uncomfortable with that. But I am happy and honored to co-host with you and have the utmost respect for both you and Delilah and what you do every single Saturday night for 3 years, right?
Thank you, Michelle. Yeah, it's a labor of love, except for sometimes it's kind of hard to get bookings, but, you know, this part of it I love. I really, really do. But so, Michelle, without further ado, would you like to make a couple of comments with regard to our guest this evening, because you're both from California?
Yeah, I mean, I love California. Great progressive victims' rights state, great state just in general. And and I know that you all just had are you in the process or have you just done the 40-year anniversary for victims' rights?
So we had that last week in Oakland.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
And is that 40 years of California doing the right thing?
Well, it's
right?
40 years of the Alameda County District Attorney's Office, which is my office. We had one of the first victim witness programs in the country. And with us at the conference were all of the people whose career started in my office and went back to Washington, D.C. when President Reagan took office. And there, one of the women who spoke is the woman who started the Office of Victims of Crime.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, especially because, you know, it's just one person and then a couple of people and then a group of people who decided, you know what, victims deserve more than what they're getting. And it's been, you know, it's been a tremendous journey since then, but at the same time, it's been such an uphill battle,
yes.
You know, even today, unfortunately. But,
right.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's amazing. you know, I guess one of the things I've been dying to ask is, what have you seen? I mean, you've been there. You're a seasoned prosecutor, correct, and attorney. What have you seen over the years that has changed for the better?
Well, when I was, before I became a prosecutor, and while I was actually still in college, I was a volunteer rape crisis advocate and a domestic violence advocate. And at those days, as you some may recall, there were really no rights for victims at all. In fact, the system was almost more traumatizing particularly to domestic violence victims. They were victims of domestic violence, sexual assault were discounted, they were marginalized, they were abused in the courtroom. And, you know, frankly, the prosecutors across the country really looked at victims as just another piece of evidence and not as human beings,
right,
who had something happen to them. So the one thing that I will say is that as we have been so vigorous in advancing the rights of victims and the voices of victims, we actually have brought faces to victims in the courtroom and in the process. And it's that it's hard to look at someone who's had a crime committed against them and ignore them. And so I think that that's been a very, it has given the entire justice system balance in terms of it isn't just what one individual did against a mindless person or society or the state. It's what somebody did to a person or to people. And that's given us a lot of leverage in the courtroom to really bring justice in the justice system.
We so need to humanize, you know, the other part of the equation that the judicial system seldom pays attention to. What, you know, whether it be if you're at sentencing or a board of pardons and paroles, I'm not sure, are you allowed statutorily to show a picture of the victim in the sentencing phase of a trial, Nancy?
We are.
You
yes,
are.
Yes,
okay.
We are.
Just so you know, I mean, the thing that I find is remarkable is that, you know, I came from California, and then when I came over to Connecticut to work, there were things going on that I don't think you would expect still going on in, you know, 2007, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And so California has really been, you know, a leader in victims' rights. And really kind of shedding a light on, I mean, Marcy's Law came out of your state. I mean, there's so many things that have happened out of your jurisdiction generally that I just hope that the rest of the country gets there sometime soon. But definitely, I mean, all that hard work keeps other people working, thinking, you know, what, California did it, we can do it too. And that's really, that's part of, I think, why your message is so important, you know, because you guys have made those changes.
And I think that, thank you. And at the same time, we have to continue to be vigilant. We keep reminding, I keep reminding the prosecutors and the victim advocates in my office now, and that we can't forget and we can't become comfortable with the system, because when we become comfortable, there's a tendency to stop focusing on making
laurels,
sure.
Right?
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
And also to communicating to our colleagues. And that's why shows like this, Donna, and the work that you're doing, Michelle, is so critically important also, because it brings notoriety and it puts it in the public's eye. So if somebody does, I now get a lot of notes from around the state from victims who said, nobody ever told me this, what can I do? And I refer it back to their prosecutor office to say, you guys need to respond to your constituent or to this victim. And, you know, I think that the more we do that and the more we keep it in the public light, keep people informed of what their rights are, then they can ask for them if they're not
right.
automatically given.
Right.
Absolutely.
And I
think that empowering the victim is one of the biggest things that we can do. Sorry, Donna, I think I partially interrupted you. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, go ahead. It's hard on the radio, believe me. I happened to download you have a Marcy's Law card and resources that people can take and carry with them or distribute. And, you know, it's a bifold card. There are no less than 17 17 rights that victims are afforded. And it has the, you know, the Steele and Attorney General right on there, and it starts out with fairness and respect, goes through protection from the defendant, victim safety considerations in the setting for bail and release, all the way to restitution. I mean, there are several rights here that most people in the general public, never mind someone who becomes suddenly a crime victim, would not necessarily know. You know, they think they know by watching Law and Order or CSI or something, and those are so you know, unlike reality. So I think to have something like this, is this something you espouse and you encourage people in your, you know, law enforcement and other people to have on their person in terms of everything spelled out in terms of the Marcy's card?
It is. And, in fact, in California, the law says that the police are required by law to give them that card. So we created a template, and then other counties can just put their own seal on it. And we're revising it because the original card had every right spelled out. And as you're pointing out, there's 17 separate articulated rights in our California Constitution. So we've abbreviated it somewhat. But we also, in my office, we send a letter to every single victim in every report, even if we don't end up filing charges. And because sometimes they haven't caught the perpetrator yet, things like that, but we get all the reports. And that card, we made it purposely to fit in the envelope. So every victim who's identified to us gets that card also.
Mm-hmm. Now, Michelle, for Connecticut and Massachusetts, I know that law enforcement are supposed to give people the information, I mean, but can you tell us what's supposed to happen in our state with regard to that?
They're supposed to give out the victim's rights. It's like a two-sided phone number list, and it was recently revised, and I know they've been looking at it, but it was interesting. I was just thinking about this when I was teaching this. I used to teach this, and I'm probably going to teach it again next year, but I used to teach this law school class on victims' rights, and I have students take projects, and one of the projects was, is this card that we give out, is it really helpful? And this one kid, I'll never forget him, he was awesome. He came back with a suggestion, which was that there'd be like three different types of cards. One would be for domestic violence, one would be for sex assault, one would be for property, and one would be for homicide victims, because the services are a little different. And the victims would get these cards, and they just start calling down the list. So they'd end up calling, you know, a sex assault victim would call, let's say, the domestic violence agency that didn't, and they would refer them over to sex assault, or somebody like, or the property crimes victim would call the Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, and be like, it was just really confusing. There was all these little numbers and all these little names, and he had that really great suggestion, and then he said there's certain things that you could put in there, like what an identity theft victim's rights are, just like little like extra information for a specific crime victim, and I thought that was great.
Like a bullet point. Yeah.
Yeah, I proposed it, and they said the police's response, which was so frustrating, was we'd drive around with a trunk full of these cards, and I'm like, no, you wouldn't. Plus, you guys got a trunk full of junk anyway. Like, come on, like you could have like five stacks of cards. Like, it'd be really simple, you know. But they do give out the cards.
It would fit in a shoebox, Michelle.
Well, and one of the things we talked about along those lines is that at the summit is the how are we tapping into technology? So rather than necessary, I mean, we, you know, have people want something in hand, and we're not going to assume that everybody will go to a computer, but we're doing a lot more with technology now. We're asking victims for email addresses if they're willing to give it, so we can give them automatic updates of the next court date. And you know, I think that the more we kind of go where victims are, so some will take the card, and that'll be something they hold in hand, and it's very important to have their piece of paper or their card. Some people want to go on and get a text message. And so we're trying to be really forward-thinking on how we can utilize technology to its maximum capacity.
Well, that is true, but I'm going to be the devil's advocate here and say, because I work very closely and am a state coordinator with a nonprofit for people who go missing, and a lot of times people who have homicide and or missing persons or whatnot are from a rural area. Maybe they don't have a lot of resources. They're not near a university, or and they don't have a lot of money. And most people may have a cell phone. But I have to say, Nancy, a lot of people who are crime victims don't have computers, or they could get to the library. But it's a big percentage. It's not like a small percentage. So I think it's all well and good that you're saying this, but a lot of the people that I know that are crime victims, some people are barely scraping together, and they don't have that access or the savvy to do that. So what's the answer for them, ladies?
Well, from my perspective, ask people. We ask people how we can best communicate with them.
Get the information? Okay.
And one of the things that does when we actually ask people that, it's also very respectful and empowering to them, not just saying, here's how you're getting the information. So we have one program we've been charting how much use it gets, where people can go online and look to see whether the person's in custody still, or record that they'll get notified in advance if they're going to be released, and also what the next court date is. And we see a lot of increase in the usage, but of course not everybody will. And so that's why we want to just make it so whomever we're working with, they have options, and they get to choose. It isn't us telling them how we're going to do it.
And I think the big difference is, and I think California and Massachusetts are similar in this aspect.
Mm-hmm.
In Massachusetts,
mm-hmm.
when the victims come into court the first time, and even police stations, there are advocates there who welcome them, greet them, sit down with them, take in information, have those questions asked, how can we, how would you like to communicate with us? How much information do you want to get? Do you want a phone call, the day before, a couple days before court? Very victim-friendly. And in Connecticut, they have a very different system where there's one victim advocate for the lower felonies and misdemeanors and one victim advocate for the felonies. So like in Hartford, you could have, five murders, 10 rapes, a bunch of robberies, and one victim advocate. And they just don't have, and they haven't recognized that they need it, unfortunately. They don't have the advocacy to really make that one-on-one connection when a victim comes to the courthouse doors. And that's part of what you're talking about, which is having that one-on-one connection, getting the information to the victim, getting information back, and finding out how the victim wants to participate. And that's a huge gap in Connecticut that, hopefully with, some education over the years, they'll realize that it's a gap.
Good
right.
point.
I think it's so important to have access to communication. And, whether it's in the setting of following a trial, or during a sentencing, or Board of Pardons and Parole. Michelle, maybe you want to articulate how important it is, and I saw this in our case, how important it is to be prepared. And you thought, going in, you go in and read the website and you see what information they have. But there was, you can use me as an example, but there were so many things seemingly that slip through the cracks, or you think it's going to happen this way, and then you go in and you have to ask a whole bunch of questions, and you find out that what's supposed to happen didn't happen. And, I think that Nancy, that in Alameda County, it's probably a lot more, in Connecticut, in our experience, it's very loosey-goosey in terms of how you found out this information. And if we didn't have legal representation, oh, my God, we just would have been, it wouldn't have turned out like it had. So, what can you say about the going in for the first time to this situation, whether it be the sentencing or a hearing? What should the victim be prepared to know and not know, and what's wrong with the picture?
I mean, I think I think it depends on the circumstances. I mean, I can use your case for an example. You were given a very short notice I think it was 2 weeks, if I remember correctly, that there was a Board of Parole hearing, and that they basically said, you can give a statement, and there was nothing, like, there really wasn't any other information given. And you and I talked over the phone, and and I'm aware you have some physical limitation. I mean, you're incredibly talented in wanting to carry that huge board like five blocks with your crutches. But that wasn't, so one of the first questions I had is there parking for, physically disabled people? There wasn't any. And then the other questions, I remember asking you, like, what was important to you? And for your family, it was really about anonymity, because this offender didn't know your whole family's name. He may only have known your father's name at best, but he didn't know anything about the family, and that was huge. And I remember we went back and forth and back and forth about, can this family be anonymous when they give their statement? And there were promises been made, but when we got there, it was like, let's just move forward. And I remember you and I both saying, they want to be anonymous. They can be victim 1, 2, 3, and 4, but they want to be anonymous. They're concerned about their safety. If this person gets out now or in 5 years, they're concerned about their safety. And they said nobody had ever asked for that. And I just got the impression that nobody ever asked, so they never knew they could. And that was really sad, because, of course, victims are going to come there and wonder about their safety. There's no way that that's not a common theme. And and then just being prepared for, what does a room look like? What's the presentation going to be? Can he see you? Can he not see you? Where is he going to be? Where is he going to be in relation to you all? I mean, all those kind of questions are really important, because sometimes I think that someone who maybe doesn't have a whole lot of experience working with victims, or maybe has just kind of not really thought about it, they're not aware. Like, I remember talking to victims when they're going to give their victim impact statement when I was a prosecutor, and saying, the offender's going to be here and I'm going to be here. I can bring you in the courtroom that will most likely be it. Like, just to help them, to rip off that. Yeah, because you're ripping off a Band-Aid of, sometimes a horrific, painful experience that you've been able to put back, in its compartment for a few weeks, months, years, so that you can just move forward a little bit. And you're getting all that back out in the open, and as much information that the victim can get. And knowing, I know that they started to get impatient with us, and I remember thinking, this is just really important information that Donna and her family need. And you guys can get impatient with me, but I'm still going to keep pushing, because they need this information to feel safe, and to, and for your impact statements to really be your voice, not just you guys thinking, hey, I just want to get through this and be done with it. You feel safe in that room knowing you're protected, and you can say what you need to say and not have to worry about all these other things. And that's the information, and each case is going to be different. But
right.
A victim has a right to feel
safe. Of the victim, there, because no one really knows. That's the unspoken person, and if you don't have any kind of representation, but it's very important from my perspective, and I think even without the rest of my family members being lighters such as I, we all painted a picture of this person who was murdered by a multiple offender in a different way. And, I think the hearing officers really got a sense of who this person was. And granted, no one is perfect, and they all have their fallibilities, and certainly, my father too, but, no one deserves to be killed over anything by anyone. And, and that's what I'm saying. And the other thing, Nancy, and I want to ask you how, if you've heard of this experience, or how your advocates prepare them, but just by happenstance, we heard, we had three hearing officers, and just by accident we heard, there's only going to be two. One dropped out. So I said, what do you mean by that? Does that mean if one person votes to keep this person in and the other one votes, to let them out? There's a tie. Well, you have to come back and start all over again. And I said, no, not acceptable. Number one, you didn't even tell us about this. Number two, you gave us no notice. Number three, you have to take vacation time from work to do this. I was really mad about that.
I remember that.
You know, it's so in the final analysis, they came up with a third person magically, Nancy, you know, to break that tie if there was going to be a tie. And I really think they were bowled over by how prepared we were. And they were astonished. They really were.
Well, and
she had these great pictures of her dad that were, you know, very large so people could see who he was. And, you know, and I would imagine that many people who have gone through that process were never empowered to bring a blown up picture and to allow, you know, the person whose life had been, you know, taken viciously to have space in that room. And, you know, and it's all about, you know, one, Donna is amazing, and two, you know, knowing that we can push because we had to, you know.
And, you know, Donna has raised this issue and advocated for this also, and that is that we videotape the statement at the time of sentencing so that then the videotape can be shown, and it brings people back to that moment in time rather than to 15 years later or whatever. And when I would write my statement, my probation report to the court, my sentencing report, that would be part of their packet at the parole hearing later, I always included pictures. I asked the family for pictures. And that way, then there was some recorded history in case, you know, something happened to the family or their house burned down and they didn't have any pictures or something like that. And I'm not saying being a parole officer is easy. Of course, it's not. But on the other hand, when you bring the humans into the room, the hearing officers cannot avoid it. They cannot avoid thinking of the crime in totality rather than just from what has this guy been doing in custody under strict attention or supervision for the last several years.
The videotape piece came up especially with your mother, Donna, because pretty clear that she was never going to do this again. And I remember, you know, wondering, because they videotape all these. So, I mean, they at least had the audio tape of the family. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and in the next parole hearing, if he asks for it again, you know, I hope that the parole board will allow Donna's mother, if she chooses, to be heard through the video, through the audio tape.
Mm-hmm.
Because she was just not going to come back.
She just melted in tears, put her face in her hands and cried uncontrollably.
Oh.
And she kept looking. Nancy, this was the I will never forget this single moment. She kept there were two TV monitors there. At the top was the offender, and at the bottom was actually his father, I believe, in another place. And I don't know if that's how they do that in California. Maybe you can tell. But she turned around, juxtaposed where she was right next to the monitor, and she kept looking for some sign of recognition of who we were, some sign of remorse, some sign of apology, and there was nothing. And I think that just kind of killed her. You know,
absolutely.
Like she thought, it just, you know, and just to see that and to see her, you know, melt in her hands, cry there and say that she can't do it again. But yet she is of that generation who is very private with their feelings. And even though I asked her and Michelle and I discussed the possibility of videotape, she didn't want to be on videotape. You know, she's just private. But, you know, like Michelle said, at least they have, and there may be other people. If, you know, these are elderly people. At that time, my mother was 80, going on 81. She's now 82. And as you get older, you just don't have tolerance for these things.
Right.
You know? So, you know, that's why I think this is so very important. And, you know, they get into their little spiel and their routine, the hearing officer, and it kind of rolls off the tongue. And then when they see all of these family members and they have an articulate written statement right there and they're going to present them one after one, and they present a different aspect of the victim and a photograph and addressing the offender right there face to face. And I think to their credit, the hearing officer actually was calling the person out on, you know, on, oh, it was an accident. Well, you shot him five times. How can it be an accident five times? You know,
right.
It was almost comic relief.
Well, I also think I got the distinct impression that either nobody went over kind of what this guy should be saying, you know, like he clearly
right.
either he didn't listen to the instruction he was given, or I mean, it seemed like he just kind of haphazardly went out there and said, yeah, I'm really sorry, I'd like to get out, you know, but it didn't even seem like he had even,
no
I mean,
one
he'd
prepared
been in there how
him.
Many, 26 years or something, and nobody ever like told him that maybe you should try to like be a little, I mean, it was so crass, just kind of the stuff he was saying and his demeanor, and also
right.
one of the parole officers said some comments that I thought were completely unnecessary, but I mean, in the future, now I know to say, if you're going to say stuff about the crime that's very detailed, can you give me a heads up so I can tell the people I'm with so that they're prepared, because there was no need for some of the stuff he had said. But I guess one of the questions I have is, you know, I love the idea, the concept, the framework of Marcy's Law, and in Connecticut there is this case that says victims do not have standing to address their victims' rights, and that makes my skin crawl, because there should be some kind of way a victim can address what is happening, especially in that particular case that came down. But in California, I guess I'm just wondering, I'm just thinking about this whole process, and I'm wondering about, you know, what does it mean in California for victims to have standing through Marcy's
Law? Well, so it's really mm-hmm. interesting, when Marcy's Law was still going through the process, what we got back in terms of concerns from prosecutors around the state is, are victims going to be able to sue me? And we had to say, look, you know, we're giving victims rights. And so I think that the issue around standing, they absolutely have standing, but it's written in law that it doesn't give them standing to override, I'll say, this isn't exactly how the verbiage goes, but basically victims have rights, but ultimately the prosecutor, they can't override the voice of the prosecutor or the decisions. But I think what has happened in the beginning, where there was a little bit of tension that existed of who's in charge of this case, that over the last several years, it has really softened up, because prosecutors now are enforcing, for the most part, Marcy's Law that we're aware of. The place where we still haven't seen as much compliance with Marcy's Law is when it's a misdemeanor level case. And, of course, there
really?
Are so many misdemeanor cases in a lot
mm-hmm.
of jurisdictions, but it doesn't mean the law only applies to those counties where they either have a lot of resources or there aren't that many cases.
Or felonies.
You know, it is the
uh-huh.
law. And
yeah.
we've had people come in with lawyers, and in California, if a lawyer is representing the victim, then technically we can't talk to the victim absent the lawyer. But I think Marcy's Law gives us the opportunity to circumvent that a little bit. Particularly, we've seen the places where we've seen this is when the defendant hires the lawyer, and the victim really isn't the client. Defendant's paying the lawyer. The defendant knows what the lawyer is saying to the victim. And so we've gone behind that relationship and actually had lawyers removed from representing victims because of their conflict. And I think it's that kind of vigilance that we not only enforce the laws, but we have to be attentive to them. And I wanted to circle back on one thing, and it comes back to some of your work, Donna, and that is, you were describing the strategy, really, about how to be the most effective with the voice that victims have at these critical points. And I think that
mm-hmm.
this comes right back to the service that you offer. And that is
mm-hmm.
from your experience, and also from having really educated yourself out of your own experience and that of your families, have really developed strategic concepts about how victims can be the most effective and how prosecutors who haven't given it this much thought can learn to either step
yeah.
aside to bring in someone who knows, like yourself, or to mm-hmm. just support the victims to reaching out to creating their strategy and then coordinating it. And I can't emphasize that enough, that if someone goes to a parole hearing, let's say, and you know, maybe there's not even a prosecutor there. Sometimes prosecutors send letters. I have a team that go to parole hearings, but we oftentimes will do it for other counties because they can't send anyone. So we'll step in for their individuals. But imagine if a victim shows up and there isn't a prosecutor there and they haven't had that much contact and they don't think about strategically, should I have brought a picture? Because as Michelle pointed out, people don't even know you can ask, can I bring a picture? And the you know, I just really want to shout out as loudly as I can the assistance from services like you do and your what you've developed on it are really incredibly empowering and critical to victims when they do come into a formal environment that's foreign to them to express themselves.
Right. And
well,
just
thank
so you know,
so
in Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
Connecticut, the prosecutors do not go to the parole hearings unless they're, I don't even know what cases they would go in. So it's mainly just a victim and the parole board.
Even more important than to have victims be have services like what Donna provides of helping them
right, or
think through a victim impact statement.
Right.
And write
yeah.
it out and, you know, learn, mm-hmm. figure out how to take the words they want, the communication they want to make, the message that they want to give. And I'm really moved by how you described it, Donna, that each one of you presented your father with a little different light. So that does a couple
mm-hmm.
things. One, it prevents a hearing officer from saying, we just heard this from someone else. We don't need to hear
right.
it again because it's different, you know, slightly different. And then it also just keeps reinforcing the human being whose life was taken and you know, gives the person who's delivering the message a structure
mm-hmm.
to do that and feel at the end of it, I didn't blow it. I thought through my words. I, you know, through the help of Donna or the service that, you know, I really
right.
was able to zero in on what I wanted to say.
Well, the other, thank you, and I totally agree with what you're saying. I have, you know, lists of sample questions that I will have people fill out after we have the initial a consultation over the phone. There are basic services, and then there are extra follow-up services, but I want to stress the point, too, and I remember from years ago, a case in New Haven, that depending upon how you articulate this, how you describe this, how moved, like in a sentencing, a judge will be, it can absolutely, and maybe not in every case, but I've seen it can absolutely change the outcome for the better in terms of getting a longer sentence. Or, you know, you think, oh, once you go into the courtroom, you know, okay, the judge has it all figured out. There's already been a deal made, you know, in terms of what this person's going to get. But it's absolutely within the realm of possibility, and depending on how well you do this, that you can change the outcome by the power of the words, how you describe what you present. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I really believe that. I mean, do you? Have you seen changes in the outcome as a result of some very compelling victim impact statements?
I tried a case that involved the defendant was trying to rob a gas. He did rob a gas station across the street from a music school, and he tried to murder the gas station attendant, and the bullet missed and went across the street through the wall of the music school, and at that time a 9-year-old boy was just finishing his music lesson. He stood up and the bullet went through his spine and severed his spine, and he immediately became paralyzed. And he's a wonderful, resilient young guy now. But when we went to court, the judge had in mind what he was going to do. And what happened was Chris, the young man who was then probably 11, in his wheelchair, came up to the place where we were so he could deliver his statement. And he had something prepared, but all he did was he turned to the defendant and said, I don't understand why you did this to me. I just don't understand it, but mm-hmm. I forgive you. And the defendant was incredibly awkward and, you know, completely missed the humanity that had just been delivered to him. And the judge increased the punishment based on the, I mean, there was a range he was already thinking about, but he gave him the maximum sentence.
The maximum,
because
yeah.
he could see that, first, this guy had no remorse, even in the face of a child saying, I'm going to forgive you so I can move along with my life.
Wow.
And
oh, my God. So,
you know, and
so
I think that had Chris not really thought through, and had we not sat down and said, what is it that you want to say? And, I mean, we were surprised that he forgave him. But, you know, for his sake, for Chris's sake, so happy that he could come to that place and just become
yeah.
a kid again, you know, not really become a
yeah.
kid again, but.
Right. And not
but particularly
have that
in parole hearings,
I
think it's
uh-huh.
critical in parole hearings where you can change the outcome.
Yeah, and I also think that one of the things when I was a prosecutor, I would do is I would sit down with the victim, and I'd give them a laundry list of different things they could ask for, you know, from sentencing structures to, you know, in, you know, restitution or counseling or stay away, or so that the victim can pick and choose pieces of a sentence that are important to them. Because sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes maybe the judge isn't, maybe the sentence is really what it should be, but that there's something else the victim's looking for, you know, and that gives the victim
more empowerment.
A little bit more empowerment, but it also gives them
right.
a little bit more clarity on what they can ask for. Because a lot of times people will say to the victims, you know, well, what do you want? You want jail? You want probation? And it's like the victim wants more to choose from. Like, you know, maybe they don't want, maybe they're jail. Like, I've had victims that want, you know, 60 years and they're never going to get it. So,
right.
you know, I'll say, I understand you want 60 years and you can absolutely ask for that. But here are some other things that you can ask for that might be appropriate, that might be something that you would like to request of the judge to do. And,
like a cafeteria menu. I mean, you give them choices, too. Is that something
yep.
that's done in your jurisdiction, Nancy?
You know, I think that is really important what you're saying, Michelle.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it is done, maybe not so much here are things you can ask for, but trying to give a place where the victim feels like they have their voices being heard, not just
mm-hmm.
of what this impact has been, but what they want to come out of it. That's also realistic. So it's like, as Michelle points out, if someone goes in and says, give them life in prison, and that's not a sentencing option.
No, that's right.
Then nobody wants to stand up there and have the judge say, no, that's not going to happen because it's not the law. You know, if I was the victim standing there, I might look at the prosecutor and go, why didn't you tell me that? So it's, you know, it's just so incredibly, it's just a real high level of sensitivity to what's the outcome,
right.
for just not only the sentence, but for that person to be able to move along with their life.
And we keep circling back to the, I don't know if you've noticed, but we've mentioned this word throughout the hour. And by the way, just letting you know, because I'm the timekeeper, we have 16 minutes left to our show. The word options, and you know what? This is never mentioned in this informal conversation with crime victims. So when we're talking about this as a whole array of this long and elongated process that you go through from when the crime happens to the very end in sentencing, wherever you can interject any kind of, if you don't have control over the ultimate sentence, and you know, everyone knows that there's going to be some kind of plea, or, you know, that at least you might have control over, like, what Michelle just talked about. Well, you can't get 60 years, but here are these four different things, and what's your important to you, or is there something else, and there's something else reasonable that, you know, we might be able to ask the judge. And, you know, it's so important because it gives them a sense of being less helpless, you know, really.
That's right.
Absolutely.
You know? So, you know, I just think we're really throwing out some good ideas here. We just have to bottle it and market it.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that's exactly what you're doing, Donna. You're you're bottling this in the form of your radio show, but also the service that you provide people is, helps exactly get to the point that you're talking about and what some of those really key things Michelle's talking about.
Yeah, I think so. And after the show, we can collaborate and maybe join forces, because when East meets West, good things can happen. And, you know, who knows? And yes, there is a monetary component with my service, although in order to kind of get things off the ground, I'm going to be very flexible with regard to that aspect. But who knows, maybe in the future, you know, as we talked about off air, there might be some other option or some other help, so that I think it's very important that potential victims that want to partake of this be focused on the service area of it and not worried about, oh, well, I can't afford this, so I'm not even going to contact Donna, or I'm not going to contact so-and-so who does this. So there's got to be a way for us to get around that, you know, monetary barrier in some way and focus on the service aspect. Do you agree?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. I would hope so, because that is the most important, you know, part of this to me. It's not about becoming rich. None of us would be doing what we're doing because we're obviously, you know, not millionaires, and we've chosen this to kind of do the right thing and help other people and pay it forward. We're not here to be millionaires, or we wouldn't be the people that we are, you know.
Right.
But I'm wondering, Nancy, from your perspective, what is it that you took away, for example, from your summit last week or so, or 2 weeks ago, with regard to the future? And what are you, I know it was a retrospective of 40 years, but what came out of that in terms of was there concrete things that we said, yes, this is what we want to do for victims, and this is cutting edge, and we haven't done this before?
Yes. So the morning of our conference was really a look back and how it all came to be. And all of the people that were involved in that, as I said, were there and spoke, and we gave them thank you awards for their hard work at the beginning. The afternoon was really about where are we going tomorrow? What is the new look of effective, respectful victim service delivery? And a couple things that came out. One of them was, how are we using technology? Because as we talked earlier, a lot of people have cell phones. They want to be kept informed, and is mailing the best way? Out here, I don't know how it is on the East, it's very rare for people to even have landlines anymore in their homes.
Mm-hmm.
It's
right,
just, you know, we're just doing getting away.
But
so it was
there's
technology.
Still the elderly.
Yes, that's
true. A lot of elderly people still don't.
That's true. And then and in terms of technology, that the use of things like Skype, where somebody who does have a computer or someone who's out of the area can communicate through the computer, but with face-to-face through the computer. So that was one area, is really not be afraid of the technology that exists that we're using in other parts of our lives. And the second part is, which I think is perhaps the most important one, is that we now recognize that there isn't any one agency that's going to be able to fulfill all the needs or the services that victims and survivors have in the aftermath of crime. So we have got to learn to all work together and work collaboratively. And think about not just, well, you were a victim of crime, so I'm only going to talk to you about that part of what happened. What we're telling people is the new, in my opinion, the new way of doing, of working and supporting victims and victim survivors is to say, okay, I know that we've got this part of crime, but it's impacting your job. So who can help us with the way you are being able to go to work and your health is now being impacted? What can we do to link you into healthcare services? As a prosecutor, I'm not going to go to the doctor with you, but I can certainly, or a victim advocate, I can certainly make sure that we're linked in, or you're linked into services, particularly if there's no means to pay and we use victims of crime funding. The same thing if people, you know, people have to sometimes have to move. I mean, we've had people whose loved one has been murdered in the house, and the survivor can't go back and live in that house. And so right. What are we doing about that? So we're really looking at the entire life of someone who...
team approach.
Exactly.
Right.
And approach things comprehensively and not
right.
in these silos that we've always operated in. No place is it more apparent to me than in domestic violence, where
mm-hmm.
we have victim advocates dealing with the domestic violence, but we also have lives that are completely disruptive, children who... relocation, you know, stay away orders. There's so much more going on. So I think that the afternoon of our conference was really challenging victim advocates to create, I like to say, I like bubbles, not straight lines. And our bubbles overlap and our straight
mm-hmm.
lines line up against each other. And we need to blur the lines and create bubbles where we can continue to support victims by, you know, sometimes doing soft handoffs. In my county, we have an Alameda County Family Justice Center, which brought all the professionals into one building. So a victim can go to one place rather than the victim going to 50 places to access services. And
mm-hmm.
so we use that as a form of a model of how you can relocate or at least build those relationships with other providers to make sure that victims are not falling through the cracks.
Wow. That, I think that's the model that we all strive for. In my opinion, and having to work with first state government in another capacity, seems to be very fragmented and siloed with regard to our victim services and even our prosecutors, I don't know, are the ones that are in charge seem to be, to me, and this is just my opinion, the more politicians, and maybe they haven't been in the courtroom for years. You know, they talk the talk, but yet I don't think they have the hands-on and the sensitivity like somebody like Michelle does, who's in the trenches every day and does this with victims. It's so important, and not to preach from your ivory towers about, you know, this is what we do in the state of Connecticut. You know, like, I'm just so tired of that approach. So I think what you're talking about is more of a grassroots. Let's collaborate. Let's work together. And you know, how can we do that if we're siloed, like you said? And I think you can accomplish so much more when you know, good people with good ideas and good hearts come together and formulate something. And you know, include victims in the conversation. I
mm-hmm.
always say this when it comes to disabilities. I happen to have just become a new homeowner in South Carolina. Now I have two mortgages. With looking at a building and saying, you know, this is not accessible for somebody else. Well, we didn't really think about this, and there's a couple little things. I was in a dressing room last week in JCPenney's, and it's like, you know, there's nothing to hang on to, and there are sharp edges where you have to sit down. And, you know, just these little things that you could do to tweak to make your experience better, whether you have a disability or whether you're a crime victim. It doesn't take a rocket scientist. It just takes people to have that experience. You know, that's
right.
what I'm saying.
I totally agree. I think that sometimes – I think that what happens, though, is that sometimes people get, they get kind of, like, you do your work day every day, every day, every day, and we sometimes forget to look at our world from the viewpoint of a victim. Like, what can the victim, what does the victim see when they look out from where they are into, you know, our courthouse, or what are their other needs, and how can we better serve them? And I think a lot of times, you know, we have to continue, and that's what we've been talking about most of this time, is thinking outside the box. Like, the
mm-hmm.
box is not the answer. It's outside the box, and how can people branch out to connect victims with services? I mean, one good thing Connecticut did do, by the way, was creating victims' rights within the workplace violence policy. And I did that right before I left them. I said, yay. But part of it was because there was a victim who had a problem with all the state employees' names appear on the state employee website and where they work. So you could Google anybody who works in the state. Like, I could look up Donna and see where her building is, and I could go find her. Well, we had a victim in hiding, and the state would not, the state website person would not remove the name or the location. So then I ended up having to call this one person. He had it gone within 30 minutes, and I remember thinking, that is ridiculous. Like, state employees, like, we should be concerned about the victim's rights. We have a constitutional right to protect victims in Connecticut, and just things like that. Like, are victims protected in the workplace? Can they hide where they are in their venue? And can they be transferred to another venue? Like, just thinking, continuing to challenge ourselves to think outside the box and see where we're missing connections.
Other little,
because they're
little
all there.
They are. I mean, another little thing, you got put directions on the website as to, how to get to the building where the board or pardons and parole was, or where you can park.
Exactly.
Just simple things. Nancy, my brother had to run outside from the conference room and feed a parking meter.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, I mean, does that make any sense? I mean, they don't put themselves in our, well, on the one hand, they can't put themselves in our role because they're not victims, but they don't, but kind of use your imagination. If you were, would you want to have to run outside from this very intensive meeting before a hearing and put coins in a meter and they don't have a place to get change? I mean, really?
Well, and you know that it isn't just running out at that point. You start thinking about it 10 minutes ahead of time saying, oh, my God,
exactly.
Is this going to be a critic? So you're completely distracted from
that's
why
right.
you're even there because you're worried about your car.
Yeah.
Right, right. And being told, it's just those simple things that just, you know, it would make it so smooth to try to look from A to Z and what would the needs be. And not to say that they would necessarily know all my needs or know that I had a disability, but could they call up and say, what are your needs? No, that didn't happen. So thank God for Michelle Cruz. You know, that's what I'm saying. So we have to take each case as an individual and look at them. And I'm even advocating for, when we do the statements, go to their home, see their home environment, see what it was like, talk to the other family members, so that you could really get a sense of what you're writing. And the words are powerful, how you put them together. And make sure that they're true to the family. You're not going to use $1,000 vocabulary if that's not, you know, what they want. But I'm a good enough writer so that I think I could alter my written language to what it needs to be, you know, just to say that. So, you know, there's just so much potential here. And I feel so good about this show because I think that we've kind of opened the door to this, and I hope we can keep in touch and continue the conversation and you know, do good things. And, hey, if you want me to come out to California, maybe I'll be there.
Okay.
You know, we can talk about it, you know, take it off on the taxes, whatever. I'm just kidding, Nancy. But
I'm not. Actually, Donna.
Oh, you're not? Okay. Well,
no,
I'm
not kidding. I think it would be.
If you invite.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But in the last minute or so, can you both of you please give some contact information? So if our listeners want to look up information, contact you on this subject matter, they can, because they're just going to be clamoring for you, I can tell. They know about me, DonnaGore.com, ImaginePublicity.com, Shattered Lives. Nancy, give your information, please.
So the email address for me is Nancy.O'Malley, O-M-A-L-L-E-Y, acgov.org. And the website for my office is alcoda.org. And we have
okay.
a lot of information on it, and on
yeah.
victim services and victims' rights and a lot of the initiatives that we have. We'd love to hear from people.
Right. And if they're not from California, you could probably refer them to somebody if they're looking for a particular service, right?
That's exactly right.
Right, that's what you do. Michelle, how about you?
My email is cruz4law@gmail.com. And I have a Facebook account. It's just Michelle S. Cruz, attorney. But I think it starts with attorney. And I have also a private, like, business Facebook page, but I never remember the website. But it is connected with Imagine Publicity. So,
right.
Yeah. So
and you do, yeah. She writes for the Connecticut Law Tribune as well, and she does a wonderful job with that. So with that, I'm going to say thank you so much, Michelle. Thank you, Nancy. Let's please do keep in touch real soon and continue this conversation so we can help victims. Okay.
Thank you, Donna, for all you do
also.
And Michelle, thank you.
Thank you.